Music is a natural human activity by Eve Goldberg. Once upon a time, in every society in which you can trace cultural history, music was a collective activity that was part of the life of a community. Pretty much everyone sang and danced, and there were special songs and dances for life events like birth, reaching adulthood, celebrating the harvest, the turn of the seasons, marriage, and death. Music and dance were an important part of the fabric of life because they brought people together, passed on information, helped create a feeling of cohesion and social unity, and so on. Sociologists and anthropologists who have studied these things have noted that one of the things that marked this kind of activity in a community is the lack of separation between the singer-dancer and an audience. In other words, there was no audience. It was a participatory activity that everyone did. The idea of whether you were good or bad at it didn't even make sense. There are some parts of the world where this is still true. Today, we in North America live in a very different society. Music is generally not something that is woven into the fabric of most people's lives anymore. It's something that we purchase, listen to, watch, but it's not something that everyone is expected to participate in on a regular basis. There is a clear separation between performer and audience. And we grow up with the idea that if we aren't brilliant singers or dancers or players or, then we should keep our mouths shut. And many of us do. We get the message that singing is a talent. Some people have it and some don't. And if you don't have it, you're out of luck. I think this is a tragedy. It means many people are alienated from their own musicality and creativity. They never get the chance to try out their voice or have the transcendent experience of being part of a large group making music together. There are fewer and fewer opportunities for people to participate meaningfully in music and other creative pursuits without being judged in some way. In that context, it's critical that we create places and spaces where people can make music together without the expectation of perfection. Places where people can sing or play purely for the joy of it, rather than for applause or adulation. Places where it doesn't matter what your skill level is, where even if the singer needs some work on their musical skills, their contribution to the spirit of the event will be recognized and appreciated. This might be a song circle, a jam session, an open stage, or some other kind of friendly musical exchange. We need these kinds of spaces because we need to bring back music making as a natural human activity.
We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams. Wandering by lone sea breakers and sitting by desolate streams. Yet we are the movers and shakers of the world forever, it seems. We, with our dreaming and singing, ceaseless and sorrowless we, our souls with high music ringing, oh, it must ever be that we dwell in our dreaming and singing, a little apart from ye. We cry to the corners from the dazzling unknown shore, bring us hither your sun and your summers, and renew our world as of yore. You shall teach us your song's new numbers and things that we dreamt not before. These words, taken from O'Shaughnessy's Minstrel's Ode, tell us that it is in our dreams, in our songs, and in our music that we create our world. This morning, I would like to share a bit of my world, a bit of my musical and my spiritual journey with you. It all began with a 9-month stay at the University of San Francisco Medical Center. I was born with my esophagus connected to my trachea. In other words, anything I ate would go into my lungs. I was not expected to live, but after several surgeries and what my doctors and parents call a miracle, I was sent home. These circumstances would later significantly affect my ability to sing. For as long as I can remember, I have felt compelled to make music. I never considered myself to be particularly talented. Musically driven would be more accurate. As a 5-year-old, I would stand on the raised hearth of our fireplace with a long green tinker toy in hand, directing imaginary singers. My mother began teaching me how to play the piano, though our lessons usually ended in tears. When you're 5 and the apple of her eye, it's just emotionally wrenching to have your mother tell you that you are playing the wrong note. My elementary school years were spent in the San Jose, California area. In 4th grade, my best friend was the school orchestra teacher. Being with my friends and playing a new instrument sounded like fun, so I began the violin. I later added the cello, the double bass, and then the oboe. Because we were released from regular class time to attend music, see, I had this figured out. By the 6th grade, I was participating in so many ensembles that I rarely spent time in my regular school classroom. At a parent-teacher conference, it was determined that I had to drop the cello, the bass, and the oboe, but I did continue with the violin at school and with the piano at home. The summer between my 6th and 7th grade years, my family moved to Idaho. Through a serendipitous chain of events, I became acquainted with a lady in our new neighborhood named Aya Tobin. She just happened to be a concert pianist and a teacher. She introduced me to Bach, Clementi, and Bartok. Through her, I learned not just how to play the right note at the right time, but how to play expressively. I felt as though I had discovered a special secret, and making music became more exciting than ever. At that same time in the Meridian, Idaho school district, there was no string orchestra program, so I had nowhere to play the violin, aside from playing alone in my own room, and I was much too social for that. As I registered for junior high classes, my thought process went something like this. They can't get me out of music that easily. I'll just take choir. Despite my previous musical training, I soon discovered that I couldn't carry a tune. The girl next to me in choir would point a little higher or a little lower to help me find the right note. Over time and with lots of work, I learned to match pitch and sing in tune. Mostly. More important, I had a wonderful and inspiring choir teacher. His name was Mr. Higginson, and he changed my life. Mr. Higginson inspired me to be the best musician and human I was capable of being. Though I loved playing instruments, there was just something far more personal about singing, and singing in a group was at times euphoric. When it came to choir, I was hooked. Throughout junior high and high school, I had wonderful musical experiences. I continued taking piano lessons and began teaching piano at 14. I accompanied and sang in school and church ensembles. My senior year, I aimed to head back east to a music conservatory after graduation. I also wanted to be faithful to my religious beliefs. Those two concepts weren't necessarily mutually exclusive, but I had been raised in the LDS or the Mormon faith. Although the LDS Church does emphasize the importance of education, I had been given an even stronger message that as a woman, getting married and raising a family superseded any educational goals I might have. I wanted to do the right thing, so I enrolled at Brigham Young University, an LDS institution for higher learning, in the fall of 1984. This is for me. Okay. Not realizing I'd been a big fish in a small pond at Meridian High School, I dove into the music program at BYU. Despite my previous choir experience, I had never taken voice lessons. My voice instructor at BYU was not encouraging. She said she heard something funny in my voice. She told me I would never be able to pass a faculty jury and that I should probably choose a different major. I was crushed. I continued taking general courses, but I drifted. Around this time, I met a guy. We were completely unsuitable for each other. But being 18, hormonal, and lacking wisdom, I married him within 5 months of our first date. Young and hopeful, I dutifully followed him to Reese Air Force Base in Lubbock, Texas, where he attended pilot training, and I continued at Texas Tech University until the birth of my first daughter in 1989. I then stayed home to be a full-time wife and mother. All the while, I taught piano lessons and volunteered as an organist, a children's music leader, and choir director for the various LDS congregations I attended. This gave me a lot of musical experience, but I still had much to learn. With the 1991 reduction in forces, we came to be Air Force refugees living in my parents' basement in Eagle, Idaho. I loved being back in Idaho near my family, but all was not well on the home front. Melinda, my younger daughter, was born during this tumultuous time. Marital issues that had been shoved down for many years eventually rose to the surface. In 1999, my marriage came to an end. I knew I had to find a way to support myself and my daughters, and I did not want to drag myself every day to a meaningless job. I wanted to do something that I would be excited about every morning when I woke up. After all the church choirs I had directed and my own school choir experience, I knew that I wanted to be a choral conductor and a choir teacher. I headed to Boise State University with this goal in mind. I was afraid I would be told what I had been told at BYU, that I did not have the right stuff. After a very shaky but passable audition, I entered the music program. My voice teacher at BSU, Dr. Christopher Rains, also heard that funny something in my voice. He sent me to a doctor to have my vocal folds checked. Upon examination, the doctor said something along these lines. The good news is you don't have nodes, which is scar tissue on your vocal folds. The bad news is that one of your vocal folds is paralyzed. Because of this, your folds come together in a malaligned and unstable way, causing problems with phonation. And this damage probably occurred during the many surgeries on your trachea when you were an infant. And as Dr. Rains liked to say, well, you'll just sing with one vocal cord tied behind your back. And when this news reached Boise State, there was talk that I would have to leave the program or switch to piano. And Dr. Rains, knowing how determined I was, felt that my voice had shown improvement in the short time he had worked with me, and it only stood to reason that I would continue to improve. So I was allowed to stay on as a music education major with voice as my instrument. After 3 years of intense study, I was able to complete the solo vocal recital requirement for graduation. While a full-time music student, I continue to care for my two daughters, teach piano lessons, and try to bring a year-long, highly contested divorce to a peaceful conclusion. I was also going through a crisis of faith. The religion of my youth was no longer functioning for me in a positive way. With the LDS emphasis on eternal families, as a newly divorced single mother, I felt painfully out of place at church. In my growing search for truth about Mormonism and Christianity, I began to read, and I read, and I read. I learned scientific and historical information that made it impossible for me to continue in good faith as a member of the LDS Church. I was also having soul-expanding experiences through music as I studied and performed in college. I felt what I would have labeled at the time as the Holy Spirit as I listened to Gorecki's Third Symphony or as I sang Randall Thompson's Ye Shall Have a Song with the BSU Meister Singers. My sense of God and the universe were expanding. Leaving the LDS Church is not something one does lightly. It was a painful and soul-wrenching process, one that broke my parents' hearts and placed a chasm between me and my daughters, a divide I have still not entirely figured out how to bridge. During my college voice lessons, which often doubled as therapy sessions, I would sometimes share my spiritual epiphanies and religious dilemmas with my voice teacher, Chris. At one point, he said, it sounds like you might fit in with the Unitarians. I subconsciously filed that tidbit of information away. Despite all obstacles, I graduated with a Bachelor of Music and Education degree in May of 2002 and began my public teaching career in the Nampa School District. I love developing the choral program and working with the young people at East Junior High in Nampa. During that time, I missed belonging to a religious community. One summer morning in 2004, I opened the Yellow Pages, looking for a church that would be flexible enough to respect my religious past and embrace my seeking. I snuck in late and onto the back row here at the Boise Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. After singing the final hymn, the woman seated next to me leaned over and without any preliminaries said, "How come you're not in the choir?" That woman was Jeanette Ross, now a very dear friend. I explained that I was a first-timer, and I told her that actually choir directing and choirs, that was what I did for a living. She informed me that a search committee was underway looking for a choir director for this fellowship. I went through an application and audition process and was eventually hired as Booth's choir director. 2 years after I began conducting the choir here, I landed the choir director position at Bora High School, one of the top choral programs in the state. This new job opportunity came within a few days of being accepted into the master's program at Cal State LA, also in choral conducting. So when blessings rain, they pour. I might be busy for a few years, but hey, I could handle it, right? Along the way, I met a wonderful man named David Scott. Although his area of expertise is English literature, we do share a love of music. His musical tastes are wide-ranging and eclectic. Knowing him has exposed me to whole new worlds of music that I might not know otherwise. David loves to burn mixed CDs for me so he can, as he would say, inflict his musical taste on me. In our early courtship, I promised that if he would burn CDs for me, I would burn toast for him. And all of this burning and burning led to our marriage about 17 months ago. A lot was happening in my life, all of it good, but way too much. I knew if I continued running the choral program at Bora High School, directing the choir here, working on my master's degree at Cal State, planning a wedding with David, and trying to nurture two daughters, and soon a new stepson, I would lose any grip on sanity that I had left. My cup was so full, it ranneth over. I needed to stop the flood. So I resigned my position at Bora and requested a three-quarter elementary orchestra position. To complement this reduction in public school teaching, my role here expanded to include all music coordination. And thanks to Mike, Susan, John, and Bob, after many years of formal schooling, I am attempting to unlearn what I have learned so that I can rock and roll with being human. What a bumpy, difficult, amazing, and glorious journey it has been. I am blessed to have a life filled with so much love and so much music. I am a music maker. And I am a dreamer of dreams. Now, enough about me. What about you? Did you know that you? Yes, you. You are a walking, breathing, living musical instrument. You are equipped and hardwired. You have a body that can stomp and snap and clap, perfect for generating the simple rhythms of a nursery rhyme like pat a cake, baker's man, or complex rhythms like those executed by African drummers. You have a larynx, your voice box, which houses your vocal folds, two delicate pieces of muscle tissue that can be altered in length and tension to produce a variety of pitched sounds. When speech is sustained, it becomes song. Hello and hello. Because you are not made of wood, unless you're Pinocchio. You are not a woodwind, but like a living clarinet. You are a human wind. You are a singer. You really are. Most people who think they can't sing or think they don't sing well think that because someone once told them something like, You couldn't carry a tune if you were given a bucket. Or would you just quit that caterwauling? Really, though, you all have the raw musical, y'all have the raw material. You might just need a little help, or maybe a lot, like me. As I mentioned earlier, I couldn't carry a tune until I was in my mid-teens. One can learn. Bottom line, every single one of you are a miraculous traveling musical instrument. You're just walking and talking around, la-di-da. As if that weren't cool enough, you have a unique timbre, a voice print like your fingerprint. No one else can sound like you. Isn't that wonderful? Think of Ray Charles and Luciano Pavarotti, Barbara Streisand and Pat Benatar. Beauty is in the ear of the listener. And there's your voice, beautiful in a way that no one else can match. Now for something even more incredible, imagine me telling you that I'm going to create a special sound system. Here's how it'll work. I'll take a few little teeny tiny bones, and then they will cause some liquid in a tube to move around, matching vibrations that are in the air, and the movement in this tube will be picked up by some microscopic little hairs, which will then send an electrical current to a receiver. The system of vibrations and bones and liquid and tubes and hairs will be the most advanced sound system ever created. Would you believe me? Well, that's what your ears do every day. As an aside, ever wonder about the old question, if someone cuts down a tree in a forest and no one is there to hear it, does it make a sound? The answer to that is no. The falling tree will create a vibration. Sound is only created in the mind. It really is all in your head. As if your ears, your built-in sound receptors weren't amazing enough, you can audiate. What's audiation, you may ask? Okay, I want each of you to think of a favorite song. Got it? Let it jingle around in your head. Just as you can picture in your mind's eye the way your living room at home looks, visualization, you can hear music in your mind's ear. That's audiation. It's your sound memory, and it informs your body's ability to recreate what you hear in your head. It happens every time you sing in the shower. It's how Beethoven was able to compose the Ninth Symphony when he had already lost the ability to hear. He heard it in his head. This loop connecting your vibrational environment to your ear, to your mind, and back to your body completes the magic circle that makes you a marvelous musical instrument. Not only that, but you respond to music physically, intellectually, emotionally, and spiritually. Have you ever watched a baby in a stroller listening to a pop tune? That baby will just pop up and down with the music. Oops, I did it again. Have you ever unconsciously started tapping your toes to a tune or swaying to Swan Lake? And you think about music, probably more so if you've had to sit through several semesters of music theory, but you do intellectually respond to music. As you stand in an elevator, you may think, my, this music is so vapid. You may hear a new band and think, how original. This music sounds like a combination of country and rap. It's crap. And music makes you feel. Imagine watching Jaws without the dun 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 dun. Where's the terror? And Star Wars without do 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 do. Where's the power and the glory? Music is integral to memory. As in the music for reflection, the song remembers when. We all have those specific melodies that transport us to a specific moment. Above all, music can, if you are open to its magic, allow you to completely transcend time and space, shattering all sense of self. Leaving earth and ego, you soar to a place beyond the stars where you are one with the sound. And that is all there is. And it is more than enough. Music has the potential to connect us with divine mystery, with something we can't really explain, but that is wonderful. You are a music maker. you are a dreamer of dreams. Now, what about all of us collectively? Human artifacts dating back to antiquity include flutes made of bone and drums made of skin stretched over logs. Anthropologists and ethnomusicologists have discovered no culture or group of people that do not sing, that do not play some sort of instrument. All cultures have musical genres that correlate to specific cultural events, such as funerals, weddings, different holidays, etc. Whenever humans get together, there is music. So to investigate music, to ask what music is and why we make it, is to ask what it is to be human. As humans, we have used music as a tool to come together in solidarity and strength. It resonates with our bodies, our minds, and our spirits, causing a collective reaction unlike any other medium. Political and military leaders have understood this. Napoleon said, "Give me control over he who shapes the music of a nation, and I care not who makes the laws." Hitler used music for dehumanizing propaganda and social conditioning. But music has also been used for the common good. Think of the freedom songs of South Africa, which helped end apartheid, or songs from the peace rallies of the Vietnam era. Music is a powerful communal force. Up until a few generations ago, before the advent of television, families and communities would sit around in the evenings and make music together for entertainment. Whether it was a Victorian mother playing the parlor piano while the children gathered round to sing, or Pa getting out his fiddle and commencing a hoedown, we made music. Somewhere along the line, a distinction arose between those who were professionally trained musicians and those who were amateurs. Amateur coming from the word amator, which means lover. So a musical amateur would simply be a lover of music. Interestingly, in many less industrialized areas, there is no such differentiation. There was once an American fellow doing research in an African village. He was invited by the villagers to join in one of their tribal song and dance gatherings. His response, "I don't sing and I don't dance," meaning he felt he lacked the expertise for a public display of his singing and dancing abilities. The villagers looked at him with confusion. "What are you talking about?" they insisted. "You can talk. You have legs." Singing and dancing to them was an expression of community. It was about the spirit, the effort, the participation, not the know-how. We are a human community. Should it be any different for us? As our distinction between professional and amateur musician has grown, and especially as our technology to record sound has increased, our propensity to make music has decreased. We often consume rather than make music. And boy, do we consume. According to a noted music neurologist and researcher, in America alone, album sales account for $30 billion annually. This doesn't include the amount made through concert ticket sales or the billions of songs downloaded over the internet. Americans spend more money on music than on sex-related industries or prescription drugs. Imagine that. There's a lot of music, and that's a lot of money. Now, I don't mean to devalue recorded music. I love listening to favorite CDs as much as anyone. However, when we predominantly consume music rather than make it, I believe something important, something vital about our humanity is lost. What does this mean for us as a religious community? Our music fuels the action behind our faith. When we come to Sunday services and experience music as a community, we might feel a sense of joyful purpose, of sacred stillness, and sometimes we completely lose ourselves in the sound and commune with mystery, transcendence, and wonder. These powerful emotions propel the work within our faith community and the work of social action within the larger world. There are opportunities for you to become more involved in the music of this place, this sacred village and religious tribe. Opportunities for you to make music as part of your spiritual practice. Of special concern to us as a community is our choir. With the number of people we have attending services each week, we really should have a choir of about 30 to 40 people, about twice the size you normally see. But before I go too far, I want to thank all who participate regularly and to those who participate when they are able. Really, though, the real joy of choral music is found being in the choir, not just listening to it. As a director, my musical choices are limited by the number of singers who come regularly. If we had a choir of 30 to 40, oh, the music we could make. We could raise the roof. You'll find a music survey in your order of service today. Please, before you leave, take a few minutes to fill it out. And there is a basket over there with a sign, and there, I think, was one over there. I don't know if it got moved. Oh, it's on the second shelf. Okay. I don't know if we could switch that. But anyway, there are two baskets. Look for the yellow paper. It says return musical survey here. And if you would please take a moment to fill it out and return it before you leave today. It will help us create greater community with our music and greater music within this community. In the end, this is not a place for segregating amateur and professional musicians. This is a place for human beings, makers of music all. True, there are certain instances when it's helpful to have someone who's trained on the piano to help play the hymns, but there is so much more to music than that. When it's time to sing, well, we can talk. Then let us sing. Do we feel an urge to move? We are not fence posts. Let us dance. You can feel it all over. Let music wash over, dissolve, and bind us. For we are music makers, and we are dreamers of dreams.